Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast.
As a president, it is always a privilege for me to find out where our grads are serving and how they're serving God around the world, and it is a blessing to have one of ours come back today to share with us what God has been doing for more than close to 30 years since he's been gone. Dr. Dwight Elcombe completed his THM at DTS in 1973, and then he and his wife moved to Europe in 1974 to launch the Campus Crusade Leadership Training Ministry behind the Iron Curtain. Dwight and Sandy have lived and ministered in Austria, Germany, and England, and currently live in Athens, where he is involved in training refugees from the Middle East, an outreach to diplomats and international business leaders, and he's been teaching at the Greek Bible College for the past 13 years. He completed a PhD at the University of Basel in Switzerland and currently serves as the Vice President for Mission Mobilization with a ministry that he represents today called NTrust. He's the proud father of two grown daughters and became a grandfather for the first time last month. Would you join me in welcoming Dr. Dwight Elcombe back to our platform this morning?
All right, good morning. It's great to see some friendly faces out there. And I want to thank Chaplain Bill just for this opportunity to share with you all this morning, and give a special thanks to Dr. Gail Seidel, also known as Wonder Woman, for making this happen and for all of her work organizing this brown bag gathering this right after chapel. And I'd like to begin by telling a story that I heard some time ago about a couple of brothers named Leroy and Jim Bob. Now, these guys were a couple of small-town troublemakers out in rural Alabama, and they'd been involved in car theft, they'd been involved in breaking and entering, spent a lot of nights in the local jail after being involved in knockdown dragouts at the bar room and at the pool hall. And sadly enough, after all this whole life of dissipation, of drunkenness and troublemaking, old Leroy died, leaving his distraught brother needing to arrange a funeral. So poor Jim Bob, these guys had never darkened the door of a church, so Jim Bob got a hold of the Yellow Pages, started looking through, and he found this real nice Baptist church that he'd driven by in his pickup truck. And so he called up the pastor and said he'd like to come talk with him. So he went over to the First Baptist Church, sat down with the pastor and told him what his request was. Well, the pastor kind of sat back, and he knew about Jim Bob and Leroy. He knew their reputation. So he wasn't so sure he was going to do a funeral for Leroy. But so Jim Bob said, well, pastor, here's what I'd like to do. If you will do a dignified funeral for Leroy, and in your eulogy say that he was an angel, I will give $1,000 to the church. So the pastor kind of thought about this for a minute too, and then he leaned back and said, well, okay, Jim Bob, we'll do it. So several days later, Jim Bob shows up in church with a flashy new suit and a tie, and he hands a check to the preacher for $1,000 and walks and sits down in the front row. Sat down in the pew. He'd never been in a place like this before. After a few minutes, a couple of his buddies, a couple of his drinking buddies, and these guys kind of wandered in. And then eventually the choir sang Amazing Grace, and the preacher finally got up to do his eulogy. Now he said, as you all know, Leroy was not a good person. He was a thief and a drunk and a barroom brawler. He was a disgrace to this community. But compared to his brother, he was an angel. Now, the key to understanding what the pastor did was context, okay? Now, as I learned more than 40 years ago from Prof. Hendricks, that context is also crucial in understanding Scripture. So, in fact, when I teach Bible study methods at the Greek Bible College, I say, if you fall asleep in class and you hear me calling on you with a question, usually if you answer context, it's probably the right answer. So my primary passage this morning is from 2 Corinthians chapter 12, 9 and 10. But before we get to chapter 12, I'd like to take a, a brief look at several passages that help set the stage for what the Apostle Paul has to say in this magnificent chapter. Now, we all tend to think of Paul as the powerful evangelist, a fearless missionary warrior with nerves of steel. But in order to see another side of this remarkable man, I'd like to read a couple of passages where Paul bares his soul about his feelings of fear and inadequacy. In 1 Corinthians 2, verse 3, he writes, "I came to you in weakness with great fear and trembling." And as I've thought about this verse, it seems that Paul's anxiety probably had a lot to do with the reputation of Corinth as a den of iniquity. And it's sort of a cross between the red light district in Amsterdam and New Orleans during Mardi Gras. And Corinth is only about an hour away from where I live in Athens. So whenever we have guests, we take them to Corinth. And once in a while, we'll take a pilgrimage up to the top of the Acra Corinth, where there's the foundation to what was the temple to Aphrodite. And according to at least one of the ancient historians, there were more than 1,000 temple prostitutes employed in Corinth to take care of the worship needs of the sailors and the traders who came through the city. So it was a real den of iniquity. And I'm just trying to picture in my mind the Apostle Paul, the devout believer in the one true God who was deeply committed to sexual purity and sanctity of marriage, arriving in a city like Corinth, full of pagan temples, including the ill-famed temple to Aphrodite. So when Paul arrived, I think he was well aware that he was entering enemy territory, where the power of sin and Satan were on display in all of their hideous perversion. Then as we read through 2 Corinthians, a letter that's arguably the most personal of Paul's letters, we find this reoccurring theme that God's power is brought to fruition through Paul's weakness. Chapter 1, verse 8 and 9, he writes, "For we do not want you to be unaware, brothers, of the affliction we experienced in Asia. We were so utterly burdened beyond our strength that we despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death, but that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead." Then in chapter 4, verse 7, he states, "But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us." And then finally, the passage I want to look at this morning in chapter 12, set the context once again, 7 through 11, Paul pens these words, "To keep me from becoming conceited because of these surpassingly great revelations, there was given to me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I'll boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I'm strong.'" Now just think for a minute about the proud young Saul of Tarsus that we encounter in Acts chapter 9. You know, here's this Pharisee oozing with self-confidence. And then compare who's kind of a rabbinical Rambo who was going from town to town rounding up the bad guys. And in his case, these are the people who were following Jesus. And compare that image of this rabbinical Rambo with the Paul that we encounter in 2 Corinthians, who is able to bear his soul about his own inadequacy. Now, as we all know, Paul had a lot of reasons that he could have been puffed up with pride. He had an impeccable Jewish pedigree. He possessed a sharp intellect. He could boast of a first-class education under one of the leading scholars of his day, and he was certainly a remarkably successful evangelist, teacher, writer, and leader. So humanly speaking, Paul had a lot of reasons to be proud. But then we read in chapter 12, he mentions the spectacular revelations that he'd received from God 14 years earlier, and how the Lord had launched a preemptive strike against spiritual pride. Verse 7, he wrote, "To keep me from becoming conceited because of these surpassingly great revelations, there was given to me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me." Now, I'm not going to launch into a detailed Harold Honer-style exposition of this passage. For one thing, I've only got 20 minutes, and more importantly, I am not Harold Honer. But briefly, I'd just like to summarize what I see as the main three points of this passage. First, the Lord made Paul painfully aware of his own inadequacy in order to drive him to dependence on Christ. And then secondly, the Lord revealed to Paul that his grace was sufficient for him. So as we sang this morning, "Your grace is enough for me." And then thirdly, Paul learned to welcome and rejoice his weakness because it prepared the way for the Lord's power to be poured out on him and through him. Now, in verse 7, he talks about this unidentified painful weakness that God used as an antidote against arrogance. And then rather than remove the thorn in his flesh in answer to his prayers, the Lord used his human weakness to teach the apostle a life-changing lesson, that my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. Now, Paul certainly doesn't use weakness as an excuse for passivity, for apathy. He's definitely not a fatalist or a masochist, and he's not wallowing in self-pity because of his weakness. He's rejoicing that the Lord chooses to use human frailty to bring glory to himself. Now notice in this section that Paul moves from a specific frailty that he calls the thorn in the flesh in verse 7 to other unnamed weaknesses in verse 9, where he writes, "Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me." Now I've asked myself, why would the Apostle Paul of all people consider himself to be weak? Now for one thing, he acknowledges in this epistle that he was not much of an orator. Compared to the, quote, super apostles in Corinth, he was apparently a relatively boring speaker who did not make much of an impression on his listeners. As Dwayne Litvin has pointed out, Paul simply did not measure up to the rhetorical standards of the Corinthians that the Corinthians had come to expect. They were used to the polished eloquence of the orators of the day, in comparison to which Paul's preaching was found lacking. He was, as he himself admitted in 2 Corinthians 11:6, only a layman or an amateur when it came to public speaking. And in addition to Paul's lack of eloquence, he reveals that he had wrestled with a number of physical ailments, including a debilitating eye condition that left him feeling weak and vulnerable. And I can imagine, too, that as Paul crisscrossed the Roman Empire preaching the gospel, that he was painfully aware that he had moved out of his own personal and cultural comfort zone. You know, here's this a Jew who understood the Jewish traditions, the Jewish customs like the back of his hand, but he's constantly in situations where he's hearing languages that he doesn't understand, where he's confronting cultural expectations that he didn't understand. And I can say from personal experience that when you're in a situation where you don't know the language, you don't know what the cultural expectations are, you can end up feeling like the village idiot. And there have been a lot of times when I've just been in desperate need of a cultural guide who can sort of take my hand and explain to me what's going on here and help me understand what to do. So I can imagine there were a lot of situations where he just felt like he was in the wrong place. And then having endured almost a constant barrage of insults and hardships and persecutions and difficulties, Paul had learned to eventually rejoice in his own weakness because he'd come to understand that the Lord uses human frailty to showcase his surpassing power. And rather than denying or try to hide his deficiencies, Paul is courageous enough to face his frailty head on and welcome weakness for the sake of Christ. Now, I've found over the years that it's difficult for me to teach or preach without quoting from Bob Dylan at least once. So here's my chance. And now, you may not all know this, but Bob Dylan was led to Christ by a graduate of this seminary in the late 70s. And shortly after his conversion, he produced an album called Slow Train Coming, and the last song on it is called When He Returns. And he asks a really pointed question that I think bears repeating over and over again. Dylan asks the question, how long can you hate yourself for the weakness you conceal? And Paul certainly didn't get caught up in that trap. And as I've studied this passage, basically I've come to the conclusion that the big idea that Paul wants us to weave into our minds and into our hearts is the truth that acknowledging our own inadequacy opens the door for the Lord to pour out His power on us and through us. In other words, welcoming weakness opens the door for God's power to come to fruition in our lives and ministries. Now, as I've been involved in ministry overseas for almost 4 decades, I've had an awful lot of opportunities to experience weakness and to feel like I was in way over my head, and a lot of opportunities to see God come through and work through me and through my colleagues, even though we felt awfully inadequate. And I'm just going to share a few examples, a few experiences, the things that I've encountered in the last 4 decades. Now, I'll start when I was a freshman at the University of Minnesota and started coming to Campus Crusade. And I'd say back then, when I started coming to Crusade, I was so shy that I couldn't lead a group in silent prayer. And, you know, I would go to college life meetings and sit in the back somewhere, and then after the meeting was over, I'd sort of find a quiet corner in the coat room and sort of stand around there and drink my fruit punch and eat my cookies and, you know, sort of terrorized at the idea of getting involved in a conversation with anybody. And at that time, God brought an amazing man into my life, a graduate of Dallas Seminary, in fact, Ted Martin, who was the direct campus director at the University of Minnesota. And he and a couple of the older students worked with me, met with me, prayed with me, and basically helped me realize that God could work through an introvert with a very severe inferiority complex like me. And he could work through me probably in spite of all of that. And when we got here to Dallas Seminary, and there were a group of us that started praying every week for Europe, there were quite a number of Europeans in the student body at the time. And then during fourth year in seminary, I was sitting right down there during the missions conference. And a man named Bud Hinkson, who's a legendary leader of a ministry behind the Iron Curtain, was up here on the platform, and he was invited to share about some of his dreams. And one of his dreams was to start a training ministry behind the Iron Curtain. And a group of us got together with Bud during the conference, and by the end of the week, 5 of us couples who were all getting ready to graduate in May had joined with Bud Hinkson to go over to Eastern Europe to try to start a ministry there. Now, you know, as I think back on this, when we all arrived in Vienna in the summer of 1974, I can sort of envision Satan with his radar screen kind of scanning the Iron Curtain and what's going on. And I don't think we made a very big blip on his radar screen. I don't think we were all that terrifying to Satan that somehow these smart guys fresh out of Dallas Seminary are going to know what they're doing or are going to make any difference. And one of the early baptisms of fire that we had to face was we had to learn the German language. And we had been advised before we got there not to learn a lot of German. So when we all arrived that summer, we had a very useful working vocabulary of words like Gesundheit, Wiener Schnitzel, Kindergarten, Sitz im Leben. I think I learned that from Dr. Walke. But we felt awfully inadequate. And there's something about being in a culture where you don't know the language, where you don't understand how anything works. It can really, really do a number on your self-image, on your just sense of your self-worth. And I mean, we all felt really, really stupid. And the Austrians were very good at reinforcing that. And in fact, one of the things that we learned is before you go to a place like Vienna, you need a lot of cross-cultural training because it's a very cross culture. But all right, somebody got it up here. That's good. But shortly after we arrived, we found that Bud Hinkson, who was not one to just sort of sit around and talk theory, he had already planned a conference for us down in Yugoslavia, and he had invited about 70 pastors and church leaders. And Bill Bright was our main speaker. And then Bud put me in charge of the conference. So a bunch of us go down there in September of 1974. We're going to put on a conference for about 70 Yugoslav pastors and church leaders. And, you know, we're fresh out of Dallas Seminary. We're going to go down there and somehow tell these guys how to do their ministry. And we felt awfully, awfully inadequate. I mean, we just realized we are in way over our heads here. But one of the positive things that came out of that conference was a couple of us met a church leader who was living way down in Macedonia in Skopje, and he was evangelizing and discipling a group of university students in Skopje who were living for Christ and witnessing for Christ in the midst of basically the smothering atmosphere of communism. And he invited a couple of us to come down and meet with his students. So my colleague Trent Hyatt and I went down to Skopje, spent several days there doing Bible studies, just having a good time. And we were really excited. This is what we had come to Europe to do. And then a month or two later, we came back for the second time. We had another interesting time, made a lot of cultural mistakes. I mean, there were several times when we just realized, well, we don't know what we're doing here. We don't understand the culture. But at the end of the time, we sat down with Ivan, who was the head of the group, and he said, well, I really like you guys. I like what you're doing. But we've talked about it, and basically, we don't need you to come again. So, you know, we had left all the comforts of home to move overseas, to go work behind the Iron Curtain, and this was our big chance. And they didn't need us. They didn't want us. And we felt like total failures. But about that time that door was closing, some doors began to open up in other places. And there was a young college student, a Polish-American from Chicago, who had moved over to Krakow to go enter the university there. And his whole goal was to start a student ministry in Poland. And Bud had met Joe Loziak at a conference, and Joe invited a group of us to come up to Poland. And we traveled around to a number of smaller towns, met Lutheran pastors, Baptist pastors, Methodist pastors, and then the last stop on this tour was a Catholic retreat center down in southern Poland called the Oasis. And, you know, the Protestant pastors were nice folks, but they usually had a little flock of about three or four Protestants that they were trying to protect, and they really didn't see much need for us. But we met a real revolutionary in the Catholic Church named Father Blachnitsky, and he was the head of a movement called the Oasis Movement. And he wanted us to come back. And he invited a bunch of us to come that summer. We came in waves every 2 weeks. We had more staff and more students coming to Poland all summer long. And while we were there, we heard Catholic priests standing up in front say, you may have been baptized in the Catholic Church. You may go to Mass every week. You may go to confession. You may do all these things, but unless you receive Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, you are not a Christian. And Father Blachnitsky was just this amazing visionary. And he gave us the opportunity to teach the scriptures to literally thousands and thousands of young Polish Catholics. And this movement basically eventually spread all over Eastern Europe. And but when we got there, none of us were from a Catholic background. None of us really understood much about Catholicism. We just basically came in there as blue-collar Bible teachers, and, you know, God used it. Got a lot of other stories, but I think I'm going to have to kind of wrap this together in just a minute. But I'll tell one more story. Shortly after my wife and I had moved to Athens, I had gone there to be an associate pastor in an international church, and it became really clear within about a half an hour after our arrival that this is not going to be a good fit. And, you know, I stuck around for about 6 months, but we had a very different philosophy of ministry with the pastor, and I won't go into all of those details. But basically, it was just time to leave. And so I resigned after 6 months, and then, you know, being the overachiever that I am, I wanted to start, you know, more sessions and Bible studies and do this and do that. And my wife, Sandy, encouraged me to, let's just take some time, let's pray, let's wait for God to open the door, and just kind of, you know, like the Bible says, wait on the Lord. So we took some time to pray and to wait. And, you know, I'm itching, at, you know, I'm chomping at the bit. I'm ready to, you know, to go do something. And during that time, I got a call from a Greek-American friend who was working with refugees down at a place called the ARC, the Athens Refugee Center. And Themis told me, I've got a group of young believers from the Middle East who have just met the Lord recently, and would you be willing to come down and teach these guys the Bible? Well, I didn't have to think about that one all that long. I said, okay, I'll do it. So I came down and met with several of these guys, and we started a Bible study session. I taught them some novel, creative ideas that I've come up with, like observation, interpretation, application, context. And so I started meeting with these guys every week for Bible study, and then it grew into a couple of times a week. And after a while, we had a regular course that we were teaching down at the ARC, and then that developed into a thing called the Athens Intensive Ministry School. You know, and basically all that started as a result of just taking the time to pray and to realize my own weakness. Because, I mean, when I started working with these guys, I knew very little about Islam, and I certainly didn't speak their language, and I don't today. But God worked in spite of the weakness, in spite of a lot of the areas where I knew I was in way over my head. And, you know, there's some other stories that maybe we'll try to tell a few of those during the brown bag. But I'd like to, as I draw it to a close, I'd just like to suggest three steps to help you apply the truths from 2 Corinthians 12 to your own life. And I don't think it's fair to teach or preach without ending up with application. First, I'd like to suggest that you identify one or two areas of weakness or frailty in your life that are especially frustrating or discouraging to you. Now, my guess is that some of these things will probably come to your mind pretty fast. It's like when I heard Don Senukian talking about the thorn in the flesh. It came to me immediately. My thorn in the flesh was the German language. So once you've identified one or two of these areas, then ask God for insight into how is He using these areas of weakness in your life to glorify Himself. And then finally, this is kind of counterintuitive, and I think it's hard for us, but thank the Lord that His grace is sufficient for you, and welcome your weakness as a part of His plan to pour out His power on you and through you. Now, I'm going to draw this to a close, and I've got a song that I would like you to just listen to that I think expresses Paul's theology of weakness more eloquently than I can. And let me just mention in closing that I'm going to be on campus today, tomorrow, and Thursday, and Dr. Goodman and I will be here together. We're going to be hanging out some over in the Walvoord Ministry Center, so if you'd like to come over and talk with us about Entrust, what we're doing, we would be happy to talk with you. And as they mentioned earlier, we've got a lot of pizza to give away right after this over at the Mitchell Ministry Center. So we'd love to, you know, talk with you as we're here for the rest of the week. So with that in mind, let's let the music go.